A little bit different lesson tonight. First part tonight, second part next week. I call this the truth about the devil. 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 8 and 9. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him, steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. About the devil. Think about it. Think about what's known about the devil, what's said about the devil, how much is real, how much is fiction, so on. And just what is the truth about the devil? You know, I wonder how many people, I'm not saying that anyone here does, but how many people think that hell is a subterranean realm of molten rock? And how many people think that the devil is some sort of man with horns and a pointy tail, dressed in a red suit, carrying a pitchfork? What do I mean? And then how many people do you suppose there are that think that the devil rules on a throne in hell? How many people think that? I'd say that there likely are many people that believe one or more of those things, or all of them. So that's kind of what we're going to look at. We're going to look at this, these kinds of things, and see, you know, how much is true? How much do we actually know about the devil? You think to yourself, well, he's talked about a lot in the Old Testament, New Testament. That's right. But now, where's truth at? Where's fiction at? And that's what we're looking at. Now, these ideas, like the ones up there and many others, where's the origin for all of this? Now, some may say that they originate in folklore, in myths and legends. Well, that might be partly true. I think they find a home there in myths and legends. And by the way, if you ever notice, it seems like every year Hollywood makes some kind of a movie where the devil plays some kind of a prominent part in this. Either as something that's serious or something that's overstated, or presents him as some kind of a entity that, you know, is not too bad and other things along that line, but, you know, it's presented that way. And a lot of what's presented about the devil from Hollywood comes from some of the sources we're looking at here. Perhaps some of this might originate in superstition, which has a lot to do with folklore and myths and legends, that kind of thing. And how about this? Now, those things being what they are, if you go back and investigate much about Catholicism, you find out that Catholicism borrowed a whole bunch of things, incorporated these things into religion, things that come from superstition, folklore, and other things. So that's entirely possible as well. And I know this, there's a work that maybe we're familiar with, maybe not, but it's called Dante's Divine Comedy. Now, it's not a comedy, ha-ha. That's what they called these kinds of long-range things. It could be have points in it that's humorous and some tragic and other things. It was a hodgepodge of a number of things. But Dante, in his Divine Comedy, the first part of it is called the Inferno. Now, what Dante did, he took some of the things that were popular that probably came from one or more or all of these sources and incorporated them into his work. And it was meant to be a play. And so there would be actors in the play. It was very popular. It went all over the place. And then that also popularized some of the ideas that folks had about the devil or hell and so on. Dante's the one that probably did more than anything to popularize purgatory. Purgatory was one of the seven levels of hell in Dante's Inferno. But the whole bottom line is that none of these things, it's not in the Bible. The molten rock's not in the Bible. Satan and how people think he looks, and like that cartoon we had up there, not in the Bible. And him ruling in hell and you know, liking it down there, sitting on a throne in hell, that's not in the Bible either. We may not say much about that last point. That usually gets everybody's attention. We might not say too much about that this week, but we'll say more about it next week. So, but anyway, just exactly what does the Bible say? You know, what is the truth about the devil? So we're going to look at a few things tonight. Now, the origin of the devil, he is apparently a created being. There's not a whole lot of information in the scriptures now about his origin and other things like that. 2 Peter chapter 2. We'll take a look here at verse 4. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4. For if God did not spare the angels who sinned and cast them down to hell and deliver them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment. Now, there's a lot of folks that think that that actually, it doesn't have to refer to the devil, but they think that he might have been one of these angels that were cast out. Jude, verse 6, has something over there. As well, it says in verse 6, the angels who did not keep their proper domain but left their own abode, he has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day. Now, the reason they think that these two passages, even though the devil's not mentioned there, it doesn't have to be him, but we find in other places that the lake of fire and brimstone is reserved for the devil and his angels. And so it's very easy to tie that in with what you find in 2 Peter and also in Jude. So that's certainly possible. And sometimes the passage, it's in Luke, I forget exactly where, but there's a passage about seeing Satan fall from heaven. Jesus said, I beheld Satan falling from heaven. People say, well, there you go. You know, he saw this. That's really not what he's talking about. It's not saying all of a sudden that this comes to mind. What happens there, if you read the context, the disciples had been sent out under a limited commission to go out and to preach and to perform miracles. And so they went out and they were successful. They had managed to cast out demons and they healed people and a number of other things. So they come back with a report to Jesus. And when they report to him and they say, you know, even the demons, even the evil spirits are subject to us. That's when Jesus said, I beheld Satan fall like lightning from heaven. He didn't say, I saw Satan fall from heaven. I saw Satan fall. When did he see? Well, he's referring to what's just happened there. Their success over the devil. So that's actually what he's talking about. But that passage has been jerked out of context and misused, you know, forever. It would almost be like if we were talking about George Washington, you know. Let's just say we're talking about George Washington and a group of people, you know, like a class, and we're talking about George Washington and they're saying this, that, and the other. And right in the middle of all this, somebody says, oh, Sears has everything. What's that got to do with George Washington? Nothing. Nothing. But you just insert that in there and say, there you go. And it might be true that Sears has everything. I don't think they do much anymore. But, you know, my point is that what's happening over there with Jesus? They're talking about this and all the success they had. And all of a sudden Jesus said, well, I remember way back there, you know. No. That's really a classic example, taking something out of context. It can happen. And it has happened. But the whole idea is, you know, and someone asked a question one time when we were talking about the devil, which led to this, you know, question that comes up often, and I've thought about it quite a bit, is, well, then that means if they were cast out of heaven, they did something, and so that would mean that there would be sin in heaven, and then how could there be sin in heaven? And, you know, I guess that's a pretty good question. You know, how could that happen and so on? Well, really, the question assumes that the disobedience is restricted to heaven, that that's where it happened. And you can't prove that at all. And sin does come through disobedience, though. That is true. And as a created being, now, not a divine being, we'll talk about that later as well, but as a created being, the devil was likely able to choose, like other created beings are able to choose. Well, let's see. That'd be like you and me, you see. And so we can choose to be obedient or disobedient. And apparently the devil and these angels would have had the same choices to make if they did sin and were cast in out and so on. Now, what we're going to do here is we're going to look at some of the names of the devil. And really, when you look at the names, I think to myself, are they names, you know, or are they designations? Yeah, a name is a designation. But they're kind of descriptive. You know, one of the things about names in the scriptures, the names back in those days, they had a meaning. You know, the name Jacob, for example. If you look it up in Strong's Concordance, or I think it's Young's, they'll have in there a supplanter. That doesn't tell you much. But what that means is trickster. Now think about Jacob. Didn't he trick Esau? Yeah. So does his name really describe his actions? And Abram was name was changed to Abraham. They sound the same. Well, yeah, because one means, you know, father. And the other one means exalted father. So just a little change. Yeah, but the names still mean things. And you could go on and look at this and see all these things and so on. And I guess the classic is that Jesus gave Peter, Simon, the name Cephas or Peter, one meaning stone, one meaning rock, about the same thing. And we understand how that'll work. So names meant things. And devil means something. Satan means something. And he has a whole host of other things that are descriptive of him. Maybe they're not necessarily names, but boy, they sure do tell you what his actions and how he operates by some of the things that he is called. So we'll look at these at this time. He's called the devil, of course, numerous times. We'll look at that in just a moment, a little bit more depth. Also, he's called Satan numerous times. Again, we'll look at that in a moment or two. But how about this? In the very first part of the Gospel of Matthew, after Jesus was baptized, he's found in the wilderness. And who it is that comes out there in the wilderness? Well, it's someone who's called the tempter, right? Matthew chapter 4, verse 3. That's the devil. What was he doing out there? Tempting. And guess what? He didn't just stop with Jesus. He continues to tempt down to this very day. That's one of the things that he does so well. He puts the temptation out like bait in a trap, and then here we are, and we jump at it, and well, there we are, we're entangled in it. Now, Jesus didn't jump at the bait. He gives us an example that you could be tempted and resist and not sin, but if you jump at the bait, then you're in, you cross the line, and sin, and then ultimately spiritual death, separation from God, is the end result. In Matthew chapter 12, Matthew chapter 12, verse 24. Now we find here that it says, now when the Pharisees heard it, they heard about Jesus and what he was doing, a miracle he had performed, they said, this fellow does not cast out demons except by Beelzebub, the ruler of the demons. Well, Beelzebub. This is kind of a derivative of the Old Testament god Baal, along that line. And so we see, there we go, and we understand about Baal and all the wickedness that was involved with him. And well, there's wickedness involved. Well, you understand how that would be appropriate there. How about Matthew chapter 13 and verse 39? In the parable of the tares, the enemy who sowed them, the tares, is the devil. The harvest is at the end of the age, and the reapers are the angels. So, he's the enemy. Or excuse me, I'm ahead of myself by one. I'll put that up there. We'll back up and get that other one. He's the enemy there. Back in verse 19 in chapter 13, we find out he's identified here in the parable of the sower, that if anyone hears the word of the kingdom, does not understand it, the wicked one comes in his heart. That is he who receives seed by the wayside. So the evil one, the enemy, in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, it's an interesting section there where Paul asks a number of rhetorical questions here in his letter. He's not asking them to find out the answers. He knows what the answers are. A rhetorical question is asked for effect. It's for the benefit of those who hear the question. Now, the answer to all this, of course, is no. He starts off in verse 14. Don't be unequally yoked together with unbelievers. What fellowship has righteousness with lawlessness? What communion has light with darkness? And what concord has Christ with Belial? What part has a believer with an unbeliever? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? For you are the temple of the living God, as he said, and so on. Now, the Belial that you see there is like the Beelzebub up there a little bit earlier. Another one that you find is in the book of Revelation. There's a few in Revelation, but you turn to Revelation chapter 12. In Revelation chapter 12 and verse 3, another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his heads, or crowns. And he also talks about his tail and other things like that. Maybe that's where they get that cartoon image from. I don't know. But now, you think to yourself, well, how does that work out to be the devil? Because you read on down through chapter 12, and you come to verse 9. So the great dragon was cast out. Now, that's that one back in verse 3. That serpent of old, called the devil and Satan. So that dragon back there, that's Satan, and he's a deceiver. He deceives the whole world. Things that are said there. And he's also called what? The serpent of old. Yeah. Where would that be at? How about in the Garden of Eden? We remember that, don't we? In Genesis chapter 3, that the devil came, the form of a serpent. And so you see all these things and think about all that and the deception and the temptation. Temptation relies on deception. It counts on it. I don't think that temptation will work unless there's deception involved and the deception is successful. Here's how it works. Something is put out as tempting. Eating that fruit on that tree, that was put out as being tempted. Okay. And then where's the deception? Well, the deception then was to convince Eve that God really didn't mean that. You will not surely die. So you see, there's the deception. And if the deception is successful, then here we go. We'll go for the temptation. I mean, like a moth to a flame. And probably end up like a moth to a flame. And that's how it works. That's how it works now. You think about these number of things here something happens and here's the husband and he thinks to himself, whatever it might be, oh, the wife will never find out. And away he goes. Or the wife thinks, oh, the husband will never find out. So we might be deceived from without, we might be deceived from within, but the temptation's there and it won't work. Unless there's the deception. I can do this. I can get away with it. It's just one time. And others say, oh, well, just this once. Something along that line. And the devil is a champion at this. You think of the number of times all through the scriptures where this is used. I wonder in the back of David's mind, you know, when the business with Bathsheba, if he thought to himself, I'll get away with this. Her husband's not around. Most of my men and my important men, they're not around. And you know what? I'm the king. Who's going to come in and confront me? Who's going to risk that? Can you think about the number of things that, you know, put in his head to deceive him? Well, that's how it's always worked. In John chapter 8, we find another one over there. You turn there and look for just a second. And by the way, I'm not saying this list is exhaustive. I thought of something else after I got all this done. I didn't really have room for it, but I'll mention it here in a moment. In John chapter 8, verse 44, you are of your father the devil, and desires of your father you want to do. There we go. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. Well, he's the father of lies. John chapter 8, verse 44. And not only that, it says that he was a murderer from the beginning. Yeah, well, that's right too. And then to look at 1 John chapter 3, I guess this is kind of summing everything up. In John chapter 3 and verse 8,1 John chapter 3, verse 8. He who sins is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. That kind of goes back to where we started, doesn't it? For this purpose the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil. Well, this is kind of anticlimactic down here, you know. He's a sinner. Yeah. The father of sins. A sinner. And he tries to convince others to join in with him. That's not uncommon, is it? You know, it talks about in 1 Peter chapter 4. About how there are those, and you know, you used to run after these things and the lust of the Gentiles and all the things that they did, the drinking and the carousing and the partying and all that. And you know what? You gave all that stuff up. But your old buddies, they know how you used to run with them. And they kind of mock and tease you and talk about that. Oh, we remember how you used to be. And what are they trying to do? Well, they're trying to get you to lighten up a little bit. Come on over here and join us. There's an expression that we have that misery loves company. If you spring off of that and think about how sin is misery, it likes company. And the devil likes company. And he wants others to join with him in participating in sin for the company. We can understand that point, I think, pretty easy. Now, on the one more. I don't have it up, you know, for the screen. But if you go back to John chapter 12. I thought about this. I was thinking about another thing and I thought about this. In John chapter 12 and verse 31, it says here, now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out. The ruler of this world. John chapter 14 and verse 30. I will no longer talk much with you, for the ruler of this world is coming and he has nothing in me. The ruler of this world. Now, there would be a lot of people that don't know much about the Bible. Oh, the ruler of this world, well, that's God. I don't think that's who it's talking about here. Do you? In these two verses? No. Talking about someone else as the ruler of this world. And this world, yeah, we live in this world, but now there's a caution about the world and the things of the world and other things like that. And what is that about the lust of the eye, the lust of the flesh, the pride of life? That's of the world, the ruler of this world. Can we make a connection here? How about John chapter 16 and verse 11? And he says in the latter part of verse 10, I go to my Father, you see me no more, of judgment because The ruler of this world is judged. Who do you think he's talking about? Who rules the world? Well, I want to suggest to you that I am absolutely convinced here that it would be referring to Satan as the ruler of the world. He's not the ruler of hell, you see. He's the ruler of this world. But again, it describes him because he's the ruler of this world. And you see a number of things here. You can surely find a few things in here where it shows how he was using the things of this world, especially with the temptation, the deception, and other things like that. Sure. What about that word devil? Well, the word devil comes from a word that looks like our word diabolical, I think. It was spelled in English letters, that's what it would look like. But the word back there, diabolos, means slanderer or accuser. Well, think about it. Well, that's what the devil relies on. Slander. And to accuse. Now, he's not going to accuse the guilty. No, that's not it. What would be the point in him accusing the guilty? He's going to accuse the righteous in order to make an impression on someone else and then to deceive the others. So it's a pretty good word there. Now, there's another word that's used in the Scriptures as the word demon. Demonion. And sometimes it's translated as evil spirit. Now, it's devil. The King James Version, a lot of times they don't make the distinction. You'll find devil for a demon or demons and things like that, devils. And that's problematic. It's devil, this word up here. This is the word up here that's in Matthew chapter 4, verse 1. The devil comes unto Jesus to tempt him, the tempter. But now, over here in James chapter 2, verse 19... Now, my memory on that is that the devils believe and tremble. That's the memory I've got. It's just pretty well burned in here. But I know that it doesn't mean devils, really. It's the word. It's this word here. It actually means demons. The demons. There's only one devil. The demons believe and tremble. And I think that because there's not that distinction that's made, that sometimes there might be confusion, not realizing that there is a difference. It's almost like the mistranslation of Hades as hell. It causes all kinds of confusion and problems. Now, the other word that's more times than any used to describe the devil, and especially in the Old Testament, is the word Satan. That's not Carlos Santana up there. That's Santanus. It would actually sound like Satan if it was said in Hebrew. The Hebrew letters up there, it's what it means. So it's a word that's kind of been transliterated. It's kind of come over from Hebrew and you'll bounced over into English to mean Satan. And again, you know, it means someone who's an adversary. That's what it means back there. Or someone who restricts. Something along that line. Someone who's an opposer. An adversary. And we started off in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8, didn't we? And it said, your adversary, the devil. Yeah. So, it's saying, Satan, the devil, he's your adversary. English word adversary in there for us to understand this. And 1 Chronicles, I've got that up there, chapter, just to show it's used in the Old Testament. It's not used very many times, but it is used. And something different than in the garden. 1 Chronicles chapter 21, verse 1. Now Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. They weren't supposed to do this. Don't go out there and number the troops, because then if you see you've got this impressive number, you'll have confidence in the number of your troops. Well, it's not the number of the troops that ever gave Israel the victory. It was always God. So don't go out there and number them and everything like that. Then you'll rely on and you'll trust in your own strength and things like that, and so that was to be avoided. But David did it anyway, and it was Satan who was behind, put this into the mind of David to do. And also in Matthew chapter 4 and in verse 10, Jesus said in the third temptation, "Away with you, Satan, For it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, him only you shall serve. So he identifies the devil there as Satan. It's all the same person. And that's where all these words come from. And like we said, you know, they have a meaning. The devil, accuser, slanderer. And Satan, it means, well, literally adversary. Now here's one. His name's not Lucifer. You hear that all the time, don't you? All the time. It's Lucifer. It's not. I have no idea where that came from. None. If you go back to the book of Isaiah. Now, some newer translations leave Lucifer out. The King James and the New King James still have it in there. But Isaiah chapter 14 and verse 12 is the only instance of this. How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. What's he talking about here? Well, it starts there in verse 5 and goes down through here. And you know, verse 4. And verse 4 is a proverb against the king of Babylon. This has got to do with the king of Babylon. Now, as far as I'm able to tell, all the kings of Babylon were men. A man. Not that Lucifer, Satan, or the devil, as some would have it, was the king of... No, it's the king of Babylon that's here. And in verse 16, after saying this about this individual and all the things, you know, about him, starting in verse 12 and fallen, and all these things you've said in your heart, and so on, and all the great things and the words that this individual would use, now powerful and mighty than he thought he was, greater than all the gods that could possibly be. Says in verse 16, those who see you will gaze at you and consider you, saying, is this the man who made the earth tremble? Who shook kingdoms? No, he didn't. The God in heaven did that, but not this man. If that's the man who's called Lucifer, I know that this flies in the face of any number of people and or relatives, including my own. And we've all been taught that. I don't know where it came from. You know, it just somehow or another has bounced over from the Bible and it has stuck on the devil for all these years. And even in songs, you know, there have been songs, you know, about the devil and his name and so on. And Lucifer will be included in there. But that's not it. Not according to the Bible anyway. Now, what the other and how they come about with it, I don't know. And frankly, you know, mistakes are made. You can't do much about the mistakes and how they were made, but you can try to kind of correct the mistakes. And really, that's what we're doing in the lesson tonight. Now, that really concludes everything I've got for tonight, except for this last part, success against the devil. There can be success against the devil. We need to be an overcomer. We can overcome him. He doesn't have the upper hand, and he's just, you know, unbeatable and unbreakable. Jesus has shown us how to defeat the devil. And how did Jesus defeat the devil? Well, the devil threw everything at him that he had when he tempted him. Threw the whole kitchen sink at him, you know, so to speak. And he met every challenge. And overcame all the challenges and came out of it successful. Now, we can use that as an example for us so we can be an overcomer as well. How about this? In James chapter 4 and verse 7, I've always liked this passage. I wish that all of us just had this burned in our memory. Two things. Number one, submit therefore to God. That's number one. That's number one thing. You got to do that before the other. But look at the other. Resist the devil and he will flee from you. There are people, religious people, I think there might be members of the church who think, I can't resist the devil. He's just too great. He's just too powerful. And I'm just so weak and there's nothing I can do about it. But that passage tells us that we can resist the devil. And it tells us that we will be able to resist the devil. But now first, we've got to submit therefore to God. I really think, you know, if I look at these two things, I think to myself, you know, what would the world say is the most difficult in all of this? Well, they'd say this over here. Well, they'd say that over there. And since they've convinced themselves that this right here is the most difficult, they'll just throw in the towel. About that submitting yourselves to God? No, just throw it in. It's useless. But I would say that this is the more difficult, to submit therefore to God. However, if it might be difficult but not impossible, and if you will do that, then you will be able to resist the devil and he will flee from you with the guidance and instruction and example of Jesus Christ. You can be an overcomer. Submit yourself to God. Obey the gospel if need be. Obey the gospel tonight. If there is one tonight that's subject to the gospel invitation, you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, you repent of your sins, you have a desire to be baptized, we can help you tonight. If you've fallen by the wayside as a child of God, you need to repent of your sins, we'd be happy to pray with you and for you, and you can be an overcomer tonight through the gospel of Christ. And by Jesus Christ. If you're subject, why don't you come while together we stand and sing.